Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And welcome to the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast. That's where we are today, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. It's early. Where two Catholic friends talk about the popular books and movies we love and the one reality we see lying underneath.
Mm-hmm. And this is episode number 23.
And we're really getting up there.
We're getting up there. And yeah, we're of legal drinking age.
Yay! That's important for Catholics.
You bet. And we're going to talk about a book called Way Station by Clifford D. Simak.
Oh, is it Simak?
You know, that's what I was, as I was saying that, I was like, do I have that right? Simak or Simak?
I say it the American way. American.
Simak. Yeah. All right.
But who knows?
Sounds good. Yeah, yeah, this guy is... I haven't read a ton of things by him, but Way Station has always been a personal favorite. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a short story, or I guess it would be a novelette, that won some science fiction award. I'm not sure. A Hugo, I think. It's called The Big Front Yard. That is kind of a precursor to this. That you know, it had the same kind of feel, the same kind of theme. And it was written a few years before.
Okay.
In fact, I looked it up right before. See, The Big Front Yard won a Hugo for Best Novelette in 1959, and then Way Station was 1963. It was published in 1963. So, yeah.
Yeah, he was on a roll, I guess.
Huh? He was on a roll.
And I've read another book. Oh gosh, what was it called? Where basically Earth is just a graveyard.
Hmm.
And somebody is sent to Earth to find something. And this is so vague. Why am I even saying it? But it had a completely different feel to me.
Uh-huh.
Because the Earth is so alien when the person comes back. Although there are trees and wilderness and everything. But there are these like cybernetic wolves or something that can hunt you. And they're
The werewolf principle? I'm looking at a list of his books. There's one called The Werewolf Principle.
No,
an astronaut returns
it was
to
called
Earth.
The City or something like that.
Oh, there
or,
is one called City, and that's that, one of
I think
his
that's
famous
it.
Ones, yeah.
And it was good, but mm-hmm. It wasn't this book. I liked this book better.
Oh, cool. Well, good. Good, good, good. All right, well, let's talk about this book.
Okay.
Okay. Well, what it's about a fellow named Enoch Wallace, who is a Civil War veteran. So he's wandering around after the Civil War trying to decide what to do with his life. He's very disoriented and very unsure what the next part of his life is going to be. And he's approached by someone who turns out to be an alien.
Who well, that's said, backstory, though.
Yeah, it's kind of backstory. But
we don't find that out till later. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, that's okay. I'm just saying
right.
It doesn't start that way. Yeah.
Okay, and then what ends up happening is this alien offers Enoch a job. And the job is basically to be the caretaker of a way station. And what the way station is a place on the galactic network where aliens will pass through. Because no one's allowed to stay and visit the Earth. No one's arriving to, you know, go check out the sites on the planet Earth because Earth is not part of, or they haven't been accepted into the League of Worlds or whatever. I can't recall
like
what they call
Federation
it.
Kind
yeah,
of the Federation.
Yeah, that's what they call it. The Confederation or Confraternity of Worlds.
That's it.
That's it. So... yeah, so nobody's arriving on Earth for that. They just pass through. So they arrive at his station. And then, you know, he can talk to them. Sometimes they give him a gift. And then when the time is right, off they go again. But they never leave his house. And that's basically the premise of the book.
Well, and it's told from the point of view of when he wrote it, which was, I think, 1963 is what my book said.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For the copyright. And it's you find out that fairly soon. So it's not like that's a spoiler or anything. But part of the benefit to him of guarding that way station or spending time in the way station is that when he's in there, the effects of time on him are erased. Mm-hmm. So he really doesn't age except for the hour that he takes to walk down the road and get the mail and talk to the mailman and come back. And this has made him quite the curiosity to his neighbors. And he lives in, I think it's Wisconsin, but I kept imagining Missouri because all the things he was describing were kind of like the little farms I'd seen around Missouri when I was relatively young, growing up part of my life there. And but it's that country feeling. Yeah, and so the neighbors aren't very close by. There's one family, and they're kind of argumentative and backwards. Then there's a little town, but he doesn't go into it. The mailman brings him anything he needs, food and mail, of course, and he gets a lot of newspapers and scientific journals. And so everybody kind of knows about him, and they just kind of ignore him, or he's a curiosity.
Right.
And then I guess the story begins, although you don't see much from this person, that a lot of it's revealed, or the curiosity about him is revealed by the point of view of an FBI agent.
Right. Yeah.
Who's discovered him and has he actually spent 10 years watching him?
Something like that.
I kept thinking, that was the part of this story, for as unrealistic as everything is because it's science fiction, that was the part where I was like, I'm sorry, I really find it hard to believe the FBI would go, yeah, just watch him for 10 years with no proof. No big deal. We believe you. And then there's a part at the end, which I also found equally unrealistic. But I won't talk about that now because we're not in spoilers. But and what you see is the Enoch, he does a lot of writing about all his encounters with these aliens. So you learn from him about what it's like to be the person running the way station. And he's had very deep thoughts. And I guess he always was a deep thinker, wasn't he? Because it talks about him lying out by the campfire in the Civil War, looking at the stars, wondering if other people were out
and
there.
And that's why the alien chose him in the first place.
Right.
Is because, you know, he said, we need someone who looks at the stars and wonders what's up there.
Yeah. And the alien's name is Ulysses, which was a great name because Enoch names him after Ulysses S. Grant, who was a hero of his. But of course, you know, what you think of is Ulysses, who goes on the long journey.
Right.
And he's like an advanced scout for the way station.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And Enoch is a good name for Enoch Wallace as well, because Enoch was the father of Methuselah, right?
Was he?
Yeah, and then
I did not. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, and then
I didn't know that.
Long, long, long life.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that. Oh, you're a gold mine.
Yeah, okay. Gold mine.
This is going in my notes.
Nice. So Enoch Wallace, you know, he's lived his life. He's, you know, just not. I mean, as I was saying, not a lot going on in his life, but, you know, aliens come in and out, and he writes about them. I mean, he's living a very calm life, I guess I should say. And then things all of a sudden start to happen at the same time. At one point in the novel, he actually comments to himself, why is this all happening at once? You know, you know, nothing's happened for a long time, and all of a sudden. But the main thing is he's starting to be noticed.
Yeah.
Not only by the FBI, but other people are starting to ask questions as well. And he calls them watchers. There's people watching me. Yeah.
Well, that's so, the FBI's recruited guys to always watch him.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what.
Right.
Because
what
the FBI guy has discovered is that although the house is still there that he grew up in, there's a little shed nearby, and that's actually where he lives. It's got a fireplace and the bed and the kitchen and all that. And then the other thing he's discovered is a grave nearby, or three graves. And it's his father, Enoch's father, his mother, and something that can't be really identified. And he takes, and what he did is it's the gravestone has this language or symbols that no one can understand, and he's taken what he found in the grave to Washington, D.C., I think, to be examined.
Right.
And that's part of what sets off one big thread of the book, although it doesn't really come up until or come to fruition until much later mm-hmm. in the story. And then the other thing is that there's a deaf mute girl who belongs to this backwards family I mentioned that lives nearby. And she and Enoch communicate on a level of, I guess, just fellow feeling and understanding. It's not like they really communicate, but they'll look at nature and smile at each other. And mm-hmm. one day he's out walking and she's standing there with a butterfly on her finger. And he could swear that he thought the second wing was all crumpled up and didn't have any dust. And then he looks again. He says, oh, no, it's just a little bent, but it does have the color. Oh, no, I guess that wing's okay. And so you get the feeling that she just cured it.
Right.
Herself.
Yeah.
That she's got some kind of an ability or a power
mm-hmm.
to make things whole.
Yeah, exactly.
And so one day she comes running and her father's been beating her.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gives her, he harbors her against her father and her brother, hides her. And so she sees the inside of the weigh station, but at the same time he makes enemies of the father.
Yeah, who demands to be let in. But yeah, now the house that he's living in was built by his father, by Enoch's father.
Yeah.
But the aliens, once he agreed to do this job, they altered the inside of it.
Yeah.
And it's impenetrable, you know. So yeah. her father says, well, I'm going to break in the house. And he says, well, go ahead. And he breaks an axe trying to break a window. So, yeah, but it's impenetrable. Yeah, and another thing that's going on kind of at the same time is he has decided that the Earth is headed to war. Devastating war. And he's done this using some kind of a math. You know, right. I don't know if it'd be, you know, call it something like Asimov's Foundation or something like that, but it's some kind of an alien math that he's used mm-hmm. to make this determination. So that worries him greatly. He thinks about it a lot. Wondering things, you know, like, is the human race ever going to be able to join this fraternity of worlds? Is it ever going to be part of this? Are we ever going to grow up enough to where we don't have to do this? And
because that's something that, I guess it was a little afterward or something in this book somewhere. It said that was something that changed in Simic's writing mm-hmm. also.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he had written things that were a lot more hopeful before, mm-hmm. and I can't remember where that was.
Yeah, I've always considered him an optimist. Even in this story, I would say that he's an optimist.
Oh, definitely. Oh, it's the back of the book here,
okay.
The book jacket. But it says that in 1952, perhaps affected by the ugly red baiting and witch hunting of the time, Simak's science fiction took on a more pessimistic tone. His famous series of short stories, which was awarded the International Fantasy Award in 1953, depicted an Earth inherited by thinking dogs. The fate of man, even the fact of his existence, was kept ambiguous. But Simak shows the dogs to be more humane rulers of the Earth than man had been.
Hmm.
Which I could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But so what I thought was interesting is after reading that little summary, this is an extremely hopeful viewpoint and optimistic, and I think it communicates overall what I love is his love of the Earth and his love of human people in general. I mean, I've rarely mm-hmm. read a more lyrical story or book in terms of, you know, wandering around and looking at nature on his walks down the road and back.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a love letter. And it would just take me to, you know, I love being in nature anyway, like that. I wish I could live in the country.
Mm.
And it just made me feel like I was there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and me really too. And it is a pastoral novel,
mm-hmm.
which means he spends a lot of time looking around. And there's a lot of passages where there's no action taking place.
Mm-hmm.
It's just his thoughts and his observations. So there is a lot of that, but it's never uninteresting. It's always very interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah, you see the other races that come through and the ones he can and can't communicate with, that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. I found them interesting. For instance, there's a race called he called them hazers because they always were surrounded by this golden haze that it turns out through later events, which I think would be maybe a spoiler. He thinks of that as their souls that you can see. And the way he describes this one group of five that would come through and would make plans because they liked him so much to bring food and plan extra time so they could talk to him and be with him for several hours. I wondered if those were almost like he imagined, the author imagined angels to be.
Sure.
Yeah, because they operated on a different plane. They loved him and talked to him and everything. And even though he didn't understand what they were talking about, he felt included and loved. But the art that they enjoyed was just, it was this synthesis of all sorts of senses and I don't know how to describe it, really.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thought. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, sure.
Well, I started seeing all these echoes in there because one of the things that was really interesting to me in this second reading especially, although I remember noticing it before, is that one of the things they say or fairly early is that other races have proven there's a, quote, spiritual force. Mm. Although it's much more nebulous than God is ever portrayed by, you know, like us. But it's like it's proven the other races. It's like, you know, there's a force of gravity. There's a spiritual force. There's, you know, all this. So they don't worry about that. They worry about connecting to it in a different way. And so Enoch postulates that perhaps that's why people have to have faith, because we don't have the proof or can't understand the proof that the other races can. So that's the way that we make contact with that spiritual force.
Right.
But it's made clear in the book that it's very important for all those races to have a way to contact that spiritual force so that they can understand each other and think outside themselves.
Yeah. And that was really interesting because, yeah, you said it just right, you know, so that we can understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're not warring with each other.
No, although he has a somewhat idealistic view of them that is interestingly revealed later. So it's not like he's the only one keeping secrets from people necessarily.
Sure, right.
And I also felt that his connection, I just felt like there were a lot of spiritual strands. I felt like the author was trying to say, maybe because of his worry about war, which everybody worried about then in the 60s, he was trying to communicate so much about our potential. Because Enoch's like the ideal person in a sense, except for his isolation from other people, because he loves the clueless people who don't have a glimpse of what the galactic life can mean for them. But as a whole, he just aches that humanity may destroy itself. And when a solution is proposed that he finds unacceptable, that, you know, like, well, we can help them. And I don't think I should say, I guess I could, but he doesn't like that solution because it doesn't allow people to reach their potential.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It involves holding them back from what their true potential could be.
Mm-hmm.
And, so in that sense, to me, he seemed like one of the saints, kind of like St. Paul, who said at one point, and I can't remember where, that he wished he could die and go to heaven because he just couldn't stand being away from Jesus after he'd had his vision of him, you know. But he would stay here and do the work he needed to as long as he was called on to do so, and he would do it with all his heart. And that made me think of Enoch, who has this love for humanity, but he's always torn because he really is dying to go and see what the galaxy is like.
Right. Yeah.
But he knows that once he leaves, he can't really come back, and he doesn't want to cut himself off from humans and the Earth. That's really important to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it would make him less human. And I was like, wow, that sounds just like a saint, you know, in that way.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It does. Yeah, and let's get into spoiler territory.
Okay. Because
there's lots of interesting stuff to discuss here. So this is our point, folks. If you want to read the book and you don't want it spoiled, this is the time to hit stop and come back later.
Yep.
And enjoy it. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's easy and fairly short.
Right.
So, you know, compared to a lot of books today.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, what you were hinting at there is he's given a choice, he's convinced that war is coming, but he has an option to, I would say, roll back the clock. It's not even that. He can dumb down the entire human race so that they don't have the technology anymore to do massive destruction. And it's basically a backing up and going up the hill once more, hopefully with a different result.
Yeah, they said it's making everybody more stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it didn't sound exactly like that. But they just, the Ulysses said, yeah, well, we can do stupidity on them, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And that made me think of some other things in science fiction. I recall a book by Orson Scott Card called The Memory of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because it was a colony of humans that had left the Earth, obviously, but due to a big war. So they were practically refugees of war. So they devised this satellite system that would detect thoughts, violent thoughts, and redirect a person. So if you were thinking, boy, I'd really like to kill that guy, it would just redirect your thought. You wouldn't remember that you thought that. And thus avoiding war. And of course, the premise of the book is those things are starting to break down.
Okay, because I was going to say, because then you never learn how to deal with diverting yourself, which is part of the point of maturity.
Yep, yep, exactly. And I think that's some of the stuff that Enoch is struggling with, too.
Right, and that's because they say he has to represent Earth. You'll be the token Earth person. And he's like, I can't decide this for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and he thinks about it throughout the rest of the book. Every now and then, you know, it keeps coming up and... He's just, you know, it's obviously a major decision. And what a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because sometimes he's saying, well, you know, wow, that would save so many people from violence. But how many people would die from starvation and disease? And is there one answer that's better than the other? And he was right. You know, you can't. Turning back the clock isn't necessarily the best way.
Yeah.
You could really see the author's kind of struggles with what would be, if you could just pick anything, what would you do? And here are the reasons you can't do these things.
Sure, sure.
I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. I mean, it's a recurring theme in science fiction that says, you know, when we're intelligent enough, if we survive this period, this incredibly violent period in our history, you know, things will happen. You know, like in 2001, when they uncovered the monolith on the moon and it signaled the aliens that we were advanced enough now.
Yeah.
I remember one called The Crystal Spheres by David Brin, in which he, a spacecraft was leaving the solar system for the first time, you know, and everybody was wondering, why have we had no contact? You know, so the spacecraft goes out to space and hits a wall. And shatters a sphere that's around. It shatters the sphere. It kills the people that are on the ship, but it shatters a sphere around the whole solar system. And once that's shattered, now contact can be made. So those poor first explorers got killed, but now it's open. And who made those spheres? You know, that's the question. But it's a recurring theme in science fiction. And here it is in, 1962 or whatever, where, we're wondering too, you know, are we going to make it through this? And I wonder what Simak would think right now, you know, we're going through a pretty tough period in our history right now.
Yeah.
But we're not throwing nuclear weapons around.
Yeah. I feel like it's more stable than the 60s or 70s with the Cold War and everybody's finger on the button kind of thing.
Yeah, and yeah, that's...
It seems like everybody's reached a detente, more or less. I mean, except for those wild cards, and you can never, you know, there's always going to be Genghis Khan over the hill somewhere.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Yeah, part
of nature.
Yeah, there's a book out right now by Steven Pinker, who's an atheist.
Yes.
And it's called The Better Angels, I think.
Right. And I haven't read it, but I've heard him talking about it.
Yeah, and I've only read a review that kind of hit some highlights about it. But it's interesting that this fellow...
an atheist. I didn't know
he
that.
He is, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And he's talking about how... We seem to have reached or the violence, overall violence as a race is going down. And right. That seems like an interesting perspective, seeing how it seems like we are mired in extremely violent behavior right now.
Well, I think that's kind of an interesting point, because is he looking at the Middle East where people are being massacred all the time? Or, mm-hmm.
or is he, he's looking at the whole
Africa,
thing.
Africa, the warlords and the...
Yeah.
He said
one of the things that I read in that review, and there's no way I'm going to be able to link to it because I have no idea where I read it, but it said yeah. it said something like, can you imagine today Germany invading Poland? And it was an example. Can you imagine a European country invading another European country? And well, it seems kind of outside the realm of possibility right now, doesn't it? I mean, to me it does.
Does it? Because I have to say, and this may make me very unpopular, I know Muammar Gaddafi was a horrible person, but I really disapproved of everybody just getting together and bombing the hell out of him to help the rebels. Because that was at a point when you couldn't tell what was going on. And I was like, oh, we all banded together and basically drove him out in support of one small group, killed him and everybody. And I'm like, I get it. He was awful. But I was surprisingly upset. I was surprised at myself that I was upset.
I don't disagree with you. You know, I'm not sure why you think people will be upset by that, because
because he was an awful person.
I don't disagree.
And,
yeah, but the
you know, but that's
what
kind
is
of
he?
The same
you know, the jury's still out on what's going
to
replace.
Well,
that.
That's true. And to me, that was kind of the same thing. I was like, if the rebels can't muster enough support on their own, is it because they're being? Is it because the regular people are held down so much by the government that's there, or is it because there's not enough support for these particular people? That was the thing where I was like, suddenly everybody's like, oh, President Obama, you're not speaking up. And I'm like, you know what? I don't mind that he takes a little while to think about it. Because essentially I felt like he was pressured into, okay, we'll supply air support because everybody else wants to.
Yeah.
That may not be right either. But that was my take on it. And I was like, you know, for everybody who complained about later about Saddam Hussein being driven out, which I approved of, because there was so much more clear evidence to me of his hold on the country and how awful things were, whether we stayed or left or whatever the reason was. I just looked at that and went, I don't know that we know that much, do we? You know?
Yeah.
So these are all those questions, like, you know, I go back and forth. I'm not necessarily logical or always take the same take. And that's kind of like this book, in a sense, where he's constantly going back and forth. But I can't agree that we're less violent or that somebody wouldn't take over. I think, I mean, look at the problem. Here's the thing we say in our house all the time. Look at the problem between Israel and Palestine. I have not seen those other countries that are in support of Palestine come forward and go, you know what? Here's a nice spot of our large country. I know that's your homeland, but we're going to give you a nice place to stay anyway. You could just live here. No, they leave them in those camps, or they left them in those camps and let them fight and fight and fight. Who stepped forward to help? No, they kind of like put these people forward and let them do their dirty work for them. We don't like Israel and we can't really, you know, come forward.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, this people may go, what, are you crazy? But that's just, you know, an ignorant person's take on it. I'm
no,
like the people
no.
who live near
and,
Enoch,
yeah,
maybe.
And I can agree. I mean, there is going to be a lot of argument about that book. In fact,
well,
I'm sure that there is already.
Yeah. I can't. I think maybe Europe is civilized, or we try to be civilized, or, you know, and we go and we help people. And we, you know, when we step into things, we are trying to step in places to help the people who need a lot of help against people who are awful to them. But I know that we don't see all the news out of China and, you know,
oh,
look
sure.
at North Korea.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you get into the problem, well, you know, if you've helped them here, well, how come you're not helping these folks over here?
Right.
And we could be at war with, you know, a quarter of the countries in the world right now
trying
if
to
we
help
wanted
them.
To be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So where do you pick and choose and why do you do it? And these are the things that people get into arguments over and may or may not agree with my particular take on it. And I, you know, it doesn't really matter because it's all academic, but it's just that I look at that and I go, how can he say that? I've been reading about Christians being slaughtered, you know, where their Muslim friends will stand up with them and go, no, stop it.
Yeah.
In different Middle Eastern countries. And I'm just like, maybe he's taking a broader view than I am, but I don't think in some places, I think it feels just like way back when you had to worry about Genghis Khan coming over the hill with his hordes.
Hmm.
And we're just lucky because we're so protected from it.
Yeah, we sure are.
You know, that's... Yep. Anyway, I didn't mean to go sideways on that thing.
That's okay. That's where we went. So this book, yeah.
but I was thinking about this book and the fact that, big spoiler, one of the things I liked is that the galaxy was not left as this pristine, so much better than every human aspect, because they have the talisman.
Mm-hmm.
It facilitates a conduit between someone who can really get in touch with the spiritual force of the universe and then help conduct it to everybody around them. So you can actually essentially communicate with God directly, in a sense. That's not exactly how it's shown here, but mm-hmm. that's how I would understand it, in a sense. And so without that, they haven't had a good custodian of it for some time. And then it's been stolen. And between those two things, all these different factions in the galaxy are starting to argue with each other. Do we go here and expand? Do we go there and expand? Well, we don't agree with what you're saying. And so we're going to all start to maneuver with each other. And pretty soon it starts like the United Nations on a bad day.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, when somebody like a terrorist type who's completely nuts, it sounds like, has stolen it, and he's come to Earth because he thinks he's going to hold it hostage for some reason. That really echoed our own behavior.
Yeah, you're right. It did.
And even though Enoch didn't really understand it, I liked the idea that without contact with this spiritual force to help everybody understand each other better, you weren't going to have peace, really.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of linked it up with regular human behavior. You've got to try harder. You've got to have a spiritual base of some sort in the way this book represents it in order to be peaceful.
Yeah. Yep.
Does that make sense?
It sure does. You bet.
Does it represent it right?
I think it does. Yeah, I think it does. Another thing in the human behavior category, mm-hmm. The fact that the FBI took that body... Yeah, we should explain that. Well, what happened is...
in the grave.
Yeah, an alien came to the Earth in the way station and died. And there was, so Enoch types on his thing, you know, where he contacts Galactic Central or whatever they called it and says, hey, this guy's dead. And they type back and they say, okay, for this type of alien, what they want you to do is they want to be buried using your customs. And you can keep his stuff. So he says, okay. So he goes ahead and he buries this alien out there on his family plot. And the other aliens... in that race, they already understand where that alien is and how his body's been treated.
Mm-hmm.
They understand all that, somehow by being connected, you know, to this spiritual force, I guess.
I think their race is like that. He was a hazer. He was hazer, one of those right. who had the golden glow on the outside. And when he died, it was interesting because he said all of a sudden he was ugly and weird looking. Yeah. And he realized that it was his inner beauty that he'd been attracted to right, all the time. Right. It's his soul.
Yeah, that's neat. Yeah. Yeah, that is a good connection to angels.
Yeah.
So, and then the FBI says, well, we're just going to take this. So they steal that body. And of course, it causes a problem because everybody in the galaxy knew that the body was taken or that this race did.
Well, just and they the were like, knew.
Yeah, the hazers knew, it. Right. But they were, you know, of course, it made them question, you know, who are these humans and and what a mess they must be.
These barbarians.
Yeah, exactly. And that fed into his belief that, hey, maybe the dumbing down would not be a bad idea. You know, I found it interesting how upset Enoch was. You know, he's trying to represent the Earth and... You know, in this argument he had with the FBI guy, finally, you know, when they finally got together, he's like, there's nothing you could have done that would have hurt me worse than what you did.
Yeah.
He was telling him. And, anyway, I thought that was fascinating. You know, humans always, you know, just leap right in and do what they think they want to do. And, you know, they have no idea what the consequences are. And that seems to be something that we do all the time.
Yeah. Well, and it's that kind of brings up an interesting point about respect for the body.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was mentioning to you earlier, I remember after I read this book for the first time that I think it was Maureen at Aliens in This World had read it and reviewed it and was really horrified. And if that wasn't you, Maureen, I'm sorry if you're listening, but was really, really horrified at the way bodies were treated in the book, because the way that you travel is basically all these way stations are set up, and it's almost like it's similar to like on Star Trek, the transporter, except it's not, it's like instead of taking your molecules and putting them back together, if that's how a transporter worked, it's basically it makes an exact copy of you and transmits like all your memories and your soul and everything, a copy of it. And or is it your real soul? But anyway, the body is all that's left, and then that's just destroyed and put into this tank that I guess recycles it or something. I don't know. And she was like, oh, my gosh, that's horrible, because, you know, Catholics, matter matters. Your body matters because Christ took on human form and kept it. You know, when he was resurrected, you saw the nail holes and he showed the sword, the wound in his side and all that stuff. So that's a very deep part of our belief. And it hadn't even occurred to me, because it was a science fiction book, to even think about that aspect of it. And but then I look at how the body of the Hazer is respected. Enoch respects it. He wants really to do what they want, and he has a hard time believing that they're fine with him following Earth customs. And then when the body's taken, it matters greatly to the Hazers, and it has to be gotten back and restored. And so that shows a respect for it. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy of how that issue was handled.
It is. That's interesting. There's a story by James Patrick Kelly, which is an excellent story, called Think Like a Dinosaur. I don't know if you've read that
Sounds familiar. I might have.
But yeah, what that is, it's a very similar thing, but it's focused entirely on the whole matter transfer thing, because again, it's almost exactly like this way station. You put a person in this matter transmitter, and then the person is copied and sent, but the thing that you copied from still exists. So normally what you do is you eliminate it. Just like in the way station, you have to destroy the body, and normally you destroy the body before it regains consciousness. And of course, in this story, that goes wrong.
Right.
And the person wakes up, and now what do? Do you kill
there's her? Two of them.
Yeah. There's one that other. Now, do you kill this one? Yeah. So it's a dilemma, but yeah, what you're talking about is a terrific story. Think Like a Dinosaur by James Patrick Kelly. That.
Well, and I tend to like his stuff. I'll have to look because he reads. He used to have a podcast, didn't he? Where he'd read his.
That's right. Yeah, he did. It was called Free Reads or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you can get that from his website. I think it's jimkelly.net or something like that.
Okay.
Let me type that in here and see if it comes up.
That was it.
Jim Kelly. Yeah, he was an early podcaster.
Yeah, he was. And I remember I would listen to his stuff, and I don't remember why. Kind of drifted away. I think he got less and less frequent with it because he got busier and busier with other things. Like this happens, and he's a writer and busy and
for sure
known.
You bet. I'll put a link to that audio story in the show notes. But
that would be
JimKelly.net is the link to his site.
Okay. Well, and thinking on it, I when I read that reaction, I was really astounded because it. Science fiction, I just take a lot of things for granted. You know, this is the universe they've set up. I'm not going to question it. And when I contrast that with how the Hazer was treated, I don't think I have a problem with it because these are aliens. They don't think the same way we do about things.
Thus the title, Think Like a Dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly. You read that.
Yeah. But I know exactly what you're saying, and it's going to be fascinating. You know, the Catholic Church, I think, serves as a break to a lot of progress, which is a good thing, in my opinion. They're always saying, stop, think about this first. Mm-hmm. You want to make clones. Yeah, hang tight. Wait a minute. Let's think about this.
Look before you leap.
Exactly. So now we're getting quantum theory where matter transmission really may someday be possible because they're doing experiments where they wiggle something here and over here something wiggles. So it's really just an amazing time. But who knows, you know, what that's going to be like moving forward.
Well, and the church always, well, there's two things this makes me think of. One is, didn't they just recently set up a commission or something to study alien life forms?
Yeah, I'd seen something about alien life. Yeah.
And I'm like, everybody acts like, oh, the Vatican did it. I mean, my Catholic women's book club was super excited over that. And I was like, I just kind of took that as they hadn't already done that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because they don't mind if you find aliens, fine. How do they relate to God?
Mm-hmm.
But then the other thing it makes me think of is that because this is such a deep part of our theology, I think this is misunderstood by people who aren't Catholic, that it's like, oh, you're against progress. It's not the old way. And really, it's that thing you're saying is they have such a deep respect for humanity and what it means to be human that they want us always to be very careful that what we're doing isn't affecting another human being unknowingly. And that's why I say in stem cell research, they don't want people using embryonic stem cells. Those were part of a baby, an embryo, you know, which can never grow to be anything but a baby. And that's why they look at that as bad. Whereas the adult stem cell stuff, where I could give you stem cells from, what is it, bone marrow or whatever, go at it.
Yeah, and not only that, they actually fund some of that research.
Yeah.
Which would surprise a bunch of people.
Things.
So, yeah.
They're all for helping alleviate human suffering and stopping disease and all that. It's just, at what price? They always want us to stop and say, at what price? And I guess that's kind of what this book does, is he's kind of musing all over the place, but it's, at what price do we make these decisions for other people?
That's an excellent point.
Kind of occurred to me is that's the really Catholic part of this, and it's the thoughtful person's part of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to look at the fact that, kind of from our conversation earlier, institutions and rulers don't always make the most thoughtful decisions for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And the deliberations that Enoch goes through are the kind that, oh, you'd wish that, you know, the North Korean ruler would do. That's just not the way
it
works.
And it's interesting, you know, if this had been a book about the president of the world having to make this same decision, you know, his thought process, his or her thought process would be totally different, wouldn't it? Because he'd be thinking about, you know, well, how does this affect this or that? It's interesting to have someone representing the entire human race that the entire human race doesn't even have a clue they're being represented by.
Right.
So it allows that person to think about what's really important, not about all this other garbage.
Well, and he's relentlessly human. I mean, the part of our humanity is nature, being attached to nature. That's why going outside for even 10 minutes can change your whole mood for the day.
Mm-hmm.
People like me who work inside and live in a city kind of tend to forget that if we don't make ourselves do it. And the fact that, like, when he's talking to Lewis, the FBI guy, for the first time, he leaves, and I was trying to find this spot, but, you know, he leaves and he's got this glow of, oh, yes, I'm not alone. Oh, wait, here it is. He was surprised to find the warm glow spreading in him, as if there had been something wrong and now it was all right, as if there had been something lost that had now been recovered. And it wasn't really because of his conversation with Lewis, which Lewis is like, I'll get the body back, no problem, which that was one of the things where I was like, really? They're just going to give that up and no problem, right? But it's because there was somebody like him now. He had a friend who he could kind of talk to about all this stuff. He was connected on a real level again.
Yeah, and that's another aspect that we haven't even really discussed, because he is alone.
He's lonely.
He's very lonely. Yeah. And he actually had some, I guess you'd call it a computer program. A couple of people constructs. There were some kind of constructs that weren't actually real that he would talk to and things. And, that kind of fell apart on him. So
he took on a life of their own and rejected their existence.
Exactly, right.
Which was interesting.
Yeah,
also.
That is interesting. Yeah. So yeah, he was completely alone. So now once he could finally talk to somebody, what a huge relief that was.
Yeah. And share everything. 'Cause he's friends with the mailman. He'll give him these pieces of wood that people give him and the mailman will carve them, or he's friends with the I can't remember her name, the girl. And, but it's nothing it's not a heart to heart friendship.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, you're really incomplete if you don't have that. But in as many ways as he can, he's still connected. I mean, he's still like, he'll think about, wow, that time when I have to go inside altogether because I'm being too noticed. He's like, I don't know if I can bear to give that up. And that is part of what makes us human, and I think we kind of forget that.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's also presented with a choice. Because the humans have kind of proven themselves unworthy, they may decide to develop another arm of the galaxy rather than keep going along this arm, which means that the Earth will be taken off the network completely.
Yeah, they'll close that station.
Yeah, so he's... I don't know if he was, I can't recall, was he given a choice or?
Yeah, he could come and join the, they were could. Like, oh, you don't
okay, so they were offering him that job or was it, I can't recall if it was a question that, you know, hey, if they offer this, am I going to take it? Or if they were actually saying, hey, if you want to, you can go to a totally different alien world and do the same job you're doing now.
I thought I thought Ulysses said, we would love for you to come and be with us because you're a favorite of everybody's.
Right, and keep collecting those pieces of wood. Yeah. I'll never forget this scene where aliens bring him gifts sometimes, and he collected all kinds of exotic wood. So this blob showed up one time, and this is a blob with a little block of wood on it.
Yeah.
And he's like, here, take this block of wood.
Vegetative matter. Thank you very much. Vegetative matter for you. You collect these? Yes. What do you do with them?
Yeah, and he's got a room full of trinkets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what reminded me of The Big Front Yard, which is... the novelette that he wrote a few years before. And it was about a guy who had a shed that kept repairing itself. And then he discovered a UFO or a spacecraft in his backyard. So it was kind of taking over his shed. And then it kept evolving. And then when he opened the front door one time, he was on a totally different planet.
Whoa.
So outside his front door was another planet. And then, but this guy, the main character in that story was a trader, you know, he would trade things, you know, here I have a bunch of these cans, I'll trade them for whatever you got, you know, type of a thing.
Rubies or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So then he started to meet aliens and, you know, trade them stuff from the Earth. Anyway, it had the same kind of a feel to it. It was, certainly wasn't as deep. It was more of the optimistic, quirky characters, you know, very, very light and fun.
I'll have to look for that.
And this one is just a little bit more thoughtful.
Yeah.
You know, but you can tell that one led to the other. He was still thinking the same thoughts and exploring the same kind of theme. You know, here it is 4 years later.
Hard.
Yeah.
Well, and actually you do get a lot of that kind of quirky thing, and sometimes it's dropped in small things, because I was just flipping through the parts I'd marked and somehow I connected this to a completely different short story, but I was telling one of the kids about it the other day where when the hazer who comes and says, okay, you know, this body's gone. And Enoch says, I have to go be sure if I'm representing Earth. I trust you, I believe you, but I have to look with my own eyes. It's just the human way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going, and the hazer says, so it is a wild planet, said the hazer. Wild here, there are parts of it are tame. My own planet is controlled, the hazer said. Every foot of it is planned. I know. I have talked to many Vegans. They described the planet to me. They headed for the barn. You want to go back? Asked Enoch. No, said the hazer. I find it exhilarating. Those are wild plants over there? We call them trees, said Enoch. The wind blows as it wishes? That's right, said Enoch. We do not know as yet how to control the weather. And so that's just one little bit of conversation, but you suddenly get a real appreciation for the wind and the trees here. And you don't think of them as those are wild plants. The wind does what it wants.
Yeah, wow.
And then you realize how it just gives you an idea of how alien the hazer's world is and our world is to him. And it's just little bits of conversation. Now, there was something I wanted to talk about, which since this book is so centered around, you know, do you stay on the Earth? Do you leave the Earth? Who's worried about war? I remember Jesse reviewed the audiobook at SFF Audio.
Mm-hmm.
And he said his problem with it was there wasn't any conflict in the story. I'm pretty sure that's what I remember.
Uh-huh.
Do you find that to be true?
No, there's conflict in the story.
It's like, don't you remember the people coming to, you know, the mob with torches toward the end? And the guy with the laser gun trying to kill him and him having to defend Lucy and... I could be wrong remembering that, but I was pretty sure we had a long conversation about it.
Yeah, it's definitely a pastoral story.
Yeah, it's gently told. But
yeah, and like I said, there's a lot of, it's a very thoughtful, you know, again, we're looking at what he's thinking and, you know, he's walking around slowly. But yeah, there's conflict because, you know, the moment that he's realizes he's being watched, that's conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because it causes him stress, if nothing else. I mean, he's worried about, you know, he doesn't want to be discovered because he kind of knows that people being people, you know, they're not going to leave him alone. It's just like, you know, the FBI saying, hey, there's an alien body. Let's go cut it open. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't that seem to be the way, though? That's like, you know, in every movie, you know, oh, let's cut it open.
Yeah,
that's
well, it's our curious nature.
Yeah, so
and our kind of heedless nature too.
Right, right. So you know, yeah, he needs the human race to be patient, and hopefully they'll join this big confraternity of worlds, right? And he's mostly afraid that it'll be screwed up, you know, by human nature.
We're not by nature patient, and we're not by nature just observers, which is kind of what you're saying, is we always rush forward into action. And it makes me think of, you know, at the end of the book, if it wasn't spoiled enough for you, here comes the big one, is the alien who, the kind of the crazy terrorist alien who comes at the end, has the talisman. He's stolen it. Mm-hmm. And Lucy Fisher gets a hold of it. That's the deaf and dumb girl. And she is, of course, the new custodian who enables everyone around her to be able to feel the peace and knowledge and wisdom of the spiritual force. And because of that, the galaxy has to take the Earth seriously.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go talk to, like, the United Nations or somebody who can then make decisions for Earth and get it together so that they can be accepted. And so that kind of answers the question that forces the action to a conclusion. And it also kind of is the universal, a shot rang out and everyone dropped dead. I mean, you know, basically right. There's not a lot to do after that. And his problems are kind of solved because he can have the best of both worlds.
Right. And he also says, can I borrow her for a minute? Because he's thinking that if he brings her to a UN meeting on the Earth,
right,
that she will affect the mood of everybody there. And, start them thinking the correct thoughts too.
Right. And then he'll take Ulysses with him, I thought, because that's
Ulysses will explain, because he needs to explain to the Secretary of State why this girl should be allowed to go into a meeting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But what all that made me think of is, like, you know, she's the chosen one, she's the whatever, but we see it all from Enoch's point of view. And I was like, again, going back to the biblical idea, and of course there are many people you could call him, but I mean, he was almost like John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
he's out in the wilderness. He's suffering all these hardships. He's not really allowed to have contact with a lot of people, but he's the forerunner. Without him, it says he was looking at that carving that the mailman did of him, mm-hmm. of the man walking against the wind. And he says he saw there was an essential loneliness of a man who walked alone. But he'd had to walk alone. There'd been no other way. There had been no other choice. It had been a one-man job. And now the job was, not done, for there was much that still must be done. But the first phase of it was now over, and the second phase was starting. And so that's what made me suddenly think of, he was the forerunner.
Hmm.
Who had to do the work to prepare the road, make
way.
Yeah,
that's neat. That's a neat way to look at that. Way, yeah. Nice.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That things could come to fruition and really be the way they're supposed to be. And right. That's possibly reaching. But that's just kind of how I saw him suddenly. He's alone in the wilderness, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. And I love, throughout our whole conversation, the thing that I really appreciate the most is the view of how the spirituality helps us understand each other.
That's key.
That is key. Yeah. And I think it's a very worthwhile piece of thinking.
Definitely. Because yeah. There's that like calling to like, for instance, when he meets Ulysses and he says he looks like a cruel clown, which makes you think of a horror movie or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, but then you saw his eyes, and his eyes were so, they told who he was inside. And that happens again and again, where it's, you have to know somebody on a different level than yeah. just looking at the surface. And that's, of course, where we rush into action and we go wrong because, I do it too. You look at somebody and you go, I don't like the look on their face. They look kind of sour.
Yeah.
And you get to know them later and you're like, the nicest, kindest, most wonderful person ever.
Yeah,
I was so stupid. And then I turn around and do it again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 That's human nature, isn't it?
Yeah. But that is the beautiful thing about this. The whole answer to everything is tapping into the spiritual force, which whatever you want to call it, if you're Catholic, of course, it's the right name, which is God, the
right.
triune God, but the one God who is three in one. But whatever you want to call it, however God has communicated himself to each person, that's the thing that allows us to kind of reach beyond ourselves.
Right.
And that's what Enoch displays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Good book.
Yeah, fantastic book. Yeah, but yeah. I urge everybody to get it read.
Yeah, yeah.
And
definitely.
I'm gonna look up some more CIMAC too. CIMAC.
Yeah.
Don't know.
I'm never
I'm
gonna.
Sorry,
remember
Mr. Clifford. Yeah.
Eva.
Well, great. So, what have we got coming up now? A couple weeks.
Let's see.
It's December.
Wow. Yep. Tokyo Godfathers already?
Yeah, this year has gone by so fast. Is it just me?
Hasn't it, though?
Oh, my goodness. Man.
Golly, Thanksgiving is soon.
Yeah, and Christmas.
Stop. No shopping.
My wife is working. We do a parade of homes as a fundraiser for the theater each year.
Oh.
And we get different people to volunteer their houses and decorate them up. And we take people kind of on a tour. And yeah, it's fun. It's great fun. But she's already working on that. And here it is. It's the first Friday of December is when the actual Parade of Homes is, but
Okay. It's
wild to have Christmas decorations out and she's looking at them and helping people get all set up. Yeah, it seems too soon.
Yeah, too soon.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I was thinking that. I guess I was doing the payroll yesterday because it was the 15th and I was, typing in the 2011 into the phone for the federal tax stuff. And I was going, how can it be December coming up? And it was just January the other day. I guess maybe that's getting old or being busy, maybe.
Being busy, I think, is it. This has been probably my busiest year on record.
Really? Yeah.
And my goal is to get less busy.
That that's my goal too. I know, I was sitting down because I promised to write a piece for the Christophers, and mm-hmm. well, promised they that makes it sound like I'm donating it. They are paying me, and I'm so excited. But oh, that's great. And I'm just mm-hmm. going, you only have half a month left to write that thing. You better get busy more than the few scribblings you've done here and there.
Yeah.
You know, it's that same thing of my deadline. So
yeah,
I want to get less busy, but not with this.
No, not with this. This
I like
is
to
not
keep
busy.
This where it is.
You bet.
So yeah, Tokyo Godfathers. Tokyo Godfathers. Something really different for us.
Fantastic.
Christmas in Japan, basically mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in modern times, and then Hogfather.
Uh huh.
Christmas in Great Britain. Oh no, on the Discworld.
Uh huh. Excellent.
By Terry Pratchett.
That's great. Yep, then, I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be fun talking.
Yeah. And then a break.
And then a break. That's right.
And then you'll pick a movie.
Yeah. You know, I was actually thinking about a really short book.
Oh.
Would that be all right?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I think I would really like to read The Life Cycle of Software Objects by Ted Chiang.
Done and done.
Oh, my
gosh. I was looking at that just the other day thinking, we should read this sometime. But
yeah, and it's you know, it's a short novella. So I think that's what I'd like to do on the 12th.
I was wondering if you'd read that yet or not.
I have read about the first third of it, and totally into it. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, I mean,
it's
Chiang
the
is just amazing.
Life Cycle of Software Objects. Is that the name of it?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So if it's all right with you, that's what I'd like to do on the 12th.
It's a fantastic book, and he looks at so much. And well, it's the way he writes everything.
Great.
Brilliant.
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay.
Wonderful. We'll do that.
Yeah. Well, that's good because. I don't know how far in advance, but I've already chosen. Some time ago, I told you I wanted to do Harry Potter, and I finished listening to the audio of Harry Potter, and the final book was so powerful. I was thinking, how could I have forgotten so much of it when it was so powerful?
Mm-hmm.
But I listened to the last 3 hours of it 3 times in a row.
Oh,
it was
wow.
like watching a great movie, and I had to keep watching it over. It was so amazing.
Wonderful. Great.
I mean, and I was like, so I guess what we could do is say it's going to be Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Okay.
And it will be talking about the whole series, but that is the mm-hmm. culmination. So that would be the thing to either review or reread. Is that
okay?
Is that okay?
Oh, of course it is. You bet. Yeah, I'm a
so
fan.
So close to mm-hmm. the other book.
Yeah, no problem at all. I mean, that's why, you know, the book is so short, and that's why, you know, I hope it's okay
it's
with
a
you, but I'm very happy to do that.
Yeah, it's a novella because I'm sorry, I have to have a Valentine's movie this year. I don't want to be too girly about it, but I've had this movie picked out for a long time.
Excellent. All right. Well, so, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. So
great.
We'll have several books in a row, I guess. And then
a couple books in a row.
Back to movies.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll see everybody. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah. And thanks for picking this book. I really enjoyed it.
I'm
so
glad. And yeah. And I... Yeah.
Yeah.
On this read, I just caught so much more. It was, I like it even more than I did when I picked it. So
it's that same thing that Enoch got talking to Lewis. It's, you know, you're going to talk to somebody who gets it too, mm-hmm. you know, on the same level. That's mm-hmm. what makes this fun for me.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. So. And
love
all of you
man.
Folks listening, thank you. You bet.
Well, okay, that's enough of that, I guess. Sorry.
Awesome.
Well, I guess we'll talk to everybody in a couple of weeks. So
all right.
Have
Will
a good
do.
Couple of weeks, everyone.
All right. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.